dead.
Blog Talk Radio.
Test. Mike.
So hopefully that's what we'll be talking about today. Mike, are you with me? Okay. Well, we're gonna have a couple of guests join us today. We'll have.
Hello, Stead.
Hello.
Stead. Hello.
I'm here.
We have contact.
I'm here.
A technical issue with Michael, apparently.
Okay. Should we just reset and start over?
No, Michael will have to make his way in. I went ahead and restored whatever glitch occurred. I apologize to our listeners, of which there were several. We have guests?
Yes, we do have guests, yes. But they should be calling in at about 9 o'clock.
Okay. And with that, I'm your co-host, unless you want to fly solo for a while.
I'm good. I can keep on running, you know. We'll see. We'll get Mike on here shortly. Maybe he can just call the number or something like that and get on for the time being.
All right, so you know Mike has audio and all mics are open and lit, so when Mike comes through, we'll be fine. At this point, I'm going to make a graceful exit. Happy Veterans Day.
Happy Veterans Day, Producer Paul, absolutely. In fact, we also have Remembrance Day going on over in England. I'm sure you've seen, if you're following the Premier League at all, the poppy that they wear on their shirt that is remembrance of all of those who fell in World War One. And, of course, as that as conflicts have continued, we have the English have absorbed additional conflicts as well on there. So this is now a time of the year in several parts of the world to remember those who have made the ultimate sacrifice
for their
country. Ah, my fellow, the host of the show is here. Mike, good to hear you.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. But, yes, it is time once again that for the worst hour and a half in soccer podcasting history.
And now
the Two
hour
Guys 19. Soccer Show. Yes, we'll call it what it is as we deal with a couple of technical issues. It wouldn't be Veterans Day without technical issues. So
that's
a happy Veterans
true.
Day.
Happy Veterans Day to you too, brother.
Yes, thank you very much. You know, to Producer Paul, to your father, to Carlos, who I don't believe will be joining us tonight, but nonetheless, a happy Veterans Day to him as well. Dude, it was an interesting week.
Yeah, big time. Really interesting. Fun.
You know, lots of stuff went on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mostly
where should
I'm
we
thinking
start,
about
my
that LSU. I'm thinking about that LSU Alabama game.
Let me ask you this. If you watch that game, did Moss step out before he caught that ball?
I didn't think so.
It looked like he did to me. It looked like he – I mean, maybe he reestablished position before he caught it. But I don't know. That was close.
Mm-hmm. It was close. But,
yeah.
I mean, that was a great game of football.
Yeah, it was.
I'm not going to lie. I'm not a huge Alabama fan. I've often said that Alabama is kind of like rooting for the devil because he simply appears in the Bible.
Oh, that's pretty good. Well, look, you know, I went to East Carolina, and our scores look like basketball scores. I think they lost 52-56, something like that. So, yeah. So I wasn't sure which game they were talking about.
But – nonetheless, that was a great one. We had MLS Cup, the return of Bayern Munich over Borussia Dortmund in their Clasico.
Mm-hmm.
Real Madrid and Barcelona both picking up wins. Juve going back top of the table. Some good Champions League action. Some good Europa League action. Manchester United put on an actual performance in attack against Partizan Belgrade. And we can't forget Celtic picking up a win in Italy over Lazio in the Europa League to advance to the round of 32.
Mm-hmm.
So as we go into this international break again, you know, much like the other last international break, lots to talk about teams in different places, you know, relative to how we feel about them. You know, Manchester United coming off of a pretty decent five-game stretch where they've only lost to Bournemouth. Meanwhile, Tottenham, on the other hand, no wins in their last five in the Premier League. But I think we really need to start with yesterday's MLS Cup. And we had it right. It went to Seattle Sounders 3-1. Coach Matt was right about that one. He said that they were going to win it handily, and they were going to do it in regulation. To be honest, I think that scoreline quite flatters Seattle Sounders.
Agreed.
Who got the opener in the 57th off of a massively deflected Kevin Libera goal that hit off of Toronto player's knee. And then a couple of really bad defensive lapses.
Defensive errors, yeah.
Gave them two more before Jozy Altidore put a consolation goal away in overtime. But I thought for massive stretches of that game that Seattle was actually outplayed. It looked in the first half like it was Toronto who was clearing all the attacking intent, but without Jozy Altidore in there, just didn't really have the ability to finish.
Yeah, and if you look at the stats of that game, I mean, you had Toronto with a significant possession advantage, which can be a deceptive stat to some extent when you think about teams that just like to control the ball and pass around the middle of the field or even in their own defensive half of the field. But you saw also significant opportunities with pressing forward, shots on goal, and you had some good defense and you had some good goalkeeping by Seattle. But Toronto was really putting the hurt on them, and it was a bit unlucky that they couldn't hit the back of the net, because you've got to wonder if they were able to score a bit earlier in the game, could that have changed the momentum and could have been gone a different way, or a game could have ended a different way. But you really see the teams can have the ball for long stretches of the game, but if they can't seem to just get one in the net, then it all it takes is one goal by the opposing side to completely shift the momentum because of the letdown. It's like you're pressing. And then in the end, a really, really, really bad deflection from a player who really was looked like he was turning, but also trying to make sure he didn't have a handball and have the ball go in the goal is it's a bit sad. And you kind of feel for that for Toronto a bit. But they also seem to press a bit higher up the field. And when they were losing possession, they weren't getting back on defense. And it seemed like that was a bit of a problem. And then you had the attack, especially what's his name, Rui Diaz, and the way he can fly down the field. They were really out of position for hard stretches of the second half. But which I understand. I mean, it's the last game of the season. You're down a goal. You're trying to win. There's nothing wrong with pressing up the field, but you would hope that defensive errors and lapse of judgment wouldn't kind of cost you a title.
And I want to make a correction. I misspoke and said Kelvin Leerdam's name wrong. I called him Litera, but it's Leerdam. But yeah, I just thought, like you did, that for so much of the game, I was surprised at how unable Seattle was to string together an attack. It wasn't that Toronto just looked so fluid. Not only that Toronto looked so fluid, it was that on the occasions when Seattle was able to get the ball away from them, they couldn't string two passes together. And it wasn't until the second half when he switched Jordan Morris and Jovan Jones that they started to get some momentum. Of course, once that first goal went in, and you could argue that there were a foul, certainly it looked like Roldan had won what could have been considered a foul, definitely normally would have resulted in a stoppage of play in the build-up to that goal. But once that goal goes in, you know, it's the 57th minute, all of a sudden, Toronto's got to press more, and Seattle was able to take advantage of Toronto pressing upfield more and take them apart in a counterattack. Their manager, Seattle's manager, Brian Schmetzer, said that wasn't their intent, that they did not seek to go into that game and sit back, let Toronto play on to them and then play for the counterattack. It was just that was how it played. And Greg Vanney, full credit goes to him for setting his team up. I think if the goals had gone in sooner, if they had had a finisher, if you had had a Jozy Altidore on top, maybe that would have made a difference. But I think that's part of the, I guess, legacy of Jozy Altidore is his inavailability, his unavailability in games where he would be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen this throughout his career in MLS, and we've seen this throughout his career with the U.S. men's national team. He's just too frequently injured to be sort of that dependable striker that you need. And they say the best availability, the best ability is availability, and that's something that we have seen over the years that he has lacked.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, his lack of goal scoring, too, in these big games is even more – I think that's even more of a thing is yes, this can be seen as if you just look at the outcome of the game and you just see who the goal scorers were looking at. Okay, Jozy Altidore was able to get one in. But then you're seeing a 93rd-minute goal. He comes in as a sub, and it's his body has kind of failed him a bit throughout his career. I'm wondering if he really stretches effectively, because it's often something like a hamstring or a quad that seems to be holding him up a bit. But you're looking at, you know, he only had one goal in this playoff run and played in one game. And that's really not – that's not what you need from if you're going to compete for that type of a title, you need to have a proven goal scorer. And Jozy – even with, I know a couple of shows ago, we went on a pretty good Jozy rant, but he still has over 100, almost 150 goals in his career, which is nothing to really sniff at. But again, though, is he able to really step up and score when it really counts the most? And that is going to be a big chunk of his legacy, which I know when he was coming up as, you know, 10 years ago as a 20-year-old, we were all really excited about his pedigree and his body and just his build and his strength and you're seeing him attack the goal the way he was and the way he started out with a bang, and to see that kind of fall off is a bit disappointing. And you know, I he's still only 30 years old though, so he has time. He just turned 30. I mean, so he has time. So to kind of turn that around, hopefully he'll be able to. Just not against the team that I support.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, it's interesting we can now put a bow on it and we can kind of look with two MLS Cup titles in the last 4 years, three finals appearances in the last 4 years. You could easily consider Seattle to be a dynasty. But it's hard to really look
like a 2010 decade
like
that. Kind of ways, yeah.
This is not a team that I think, at least not this year, they haven't been that dominant team. A couple of years ago, we thought it was all just a matter of waiting on it to be Toronto and Seattle in the MLS Cup Finals. We certainly didn't necessarily see that coming. This is the first time, really, that I picked them to win. And it took them getting through a couple of rounds of playoffs before I believed in them. It's a team effort. It's not a team of stars. You know, Chad Marshall went down with a knee injury severe enough about a quarter of the way through the season that he had to retire. They don't have that, I guess, marquee player. I think Jordan Morris would be the closest thing to it. It's not like they have a Clint Dempsey anymore. They don't have a Michael Bradley. They don't have a Jozy Altidore. It's tough to look at Jordan Morris as an established star. And a lot of that has to do with his absence for much of the last 2 years due to injury.
Right.
And he's just now getting back into a position where he can reestablish himself on the U.S. men's national team. We haven't seen enough of him. This is a team that's made up of parts. They were good enough, they were well-coached enough that they were able to put together this run. Would I be at all surprised if they made it back to the playoffs or to the MLS Cup Finals next year? No. Would I also be at all surprised if they missed out entirely?
No.
they just don't feel like a team that has that sort of staying power. There's just a missing ingredient that I'm used to seeing when I talk about a dynastic sort of team.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have that. They didn't run away and hide with the Western Conference like a LAFC did or Atlanta United did last year. There wasn't this sense of this air of inevitability about this championship. But hey, two MLS Cup finals in 4 years, three finals in 4 years, and I think they're third overall. So, and it's a team that's only really been around 10 years.
Right.
And we got to talk about their support. You know, they came in one of the best supporting teams. It's only been recently that Atlanta United have overtaken them in terms of average and annual attendance. And the second biggest crowd for an MLS Cup final with 70,000 people in the stands yesterday at CenturyLink.
Yeah, that was part of when they came up. They were talking about the support they were going to have and how the Pacific Northwest is a really solid and has a strong soccer community up there, and there are lots of talent up there. There's lots of players who've been featured for both the men's and women's national team that are from that Pacific Northwest area, and you're seeing the rivalry they have with the Portland Timbers squad, and those have been some of the more marquee games, I think, to attend if you're an MLS fan. And if you're a soccer fan up there, those are rowdy games. And it appears from the lay fan watching on television that it would be a really fun atmosphere to be in. And to have them both sort of join the league around the same time, and Seattle has this kind of appetite for the game that I don't think is really – it's hard to equate that in any area of the United States that doesn't also have a very strong Latino, Hispanic, immigrant community there as well. And so you could see this being a spot where I think the national team should be looking to play more games there, especially in some of the warmer months of the year, because it's a place where they can play and actually might be able to get a bit more of a home partisan crowd than they can, and especially places such as L.A., or Dallas, or even in parts of the East Coast. So I think if MLS should capitalize on this, and really, and we were talking about the ticket prices last week, and we were talking about how this seems to be a hot ticket to get, and you saw that from watching it on television, that this could be something that American soccer can really grow on. The biggest hope is that this just turns into more talent and ability to compete in the world stage, which, of course, that's been the question we've been asking for really since 1994. So
I think they would play more games up there. The big problem that you have to deal with in Seattle, though, is turf field.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of national teams are going to go, I ain't playing on a turf field.
Well, the men's team doesn't play on turf fields. And I know the women have resisted it.
Right, they feel like they've been forced to.
Doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for a tournament, which I would suspect would be held up there, when the World Cup comes, I suspect there will be games in there. They'll do what they did at Giant Stadium, and they'll do what they do in Atlanta, which is to put a grass field down.
Yeah,
for it.
They did it up in Detroit back in 94.
Yeah, and they did it in the Meadowlands. They'll do it in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
They'll put I just think the expense to put one down for one game is not worth it.
No.
So you don't see them do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the surface in Portland is still natural grass, but I'm not sure Portland Stadium is big enough for a marquee game. But we have seen them play in smaller stadiums. But it would be nice to have up in the Pacific Northwest. They seem to like playing in San Francisco, which is about as far up the Northwest as they get.
It'll be
interesting to see if they go now with San Francisco coming into MLS, or Sacramento, if they start to play games up there as well.
Yeah.
But they like that Northern California, Pacific Northwest sort of area.
Good stuff.
But
it'll be good.
So now we can officially put a bow, though, on the 2019 MLS season. It was an interesting one. Lots of runs. I think in a way it was the prototypical MLS season.
Yeah.
Where there was so much equality, if you will, up and down the ranks, that despite the fact that you had a team like LAFC who were dominant from start to finish,
mm-hmm.
that points record, a goal scoring record, they still don't end up as the MLS Cup champions.
Mm-hmm.
At one point in time, as I think there were at least four different leaders of the Eastern Conference at different points throughout the season.
Right.
And this is after multiple games get played. I'm not going to mm-hmm. start with the who led it after one game. But DC United got off to a solid start. They made way for the Philadelphia Union, who led for a fair amount of time before Atlanta United took it. And then ultimately it went to NYCFC.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the play on the field was good. This was one of the better ones. It was close. It was exciting.
You mm-hmm.
had teams that were beating each other. But there was still a lot of talent in it. I guess my one big complaint would be we still have some stadium issues that we need
mm-hmm.
to work out.
Yes.
I think it is a mistake that NYCFC had played their home playoff game, their game against Toronto, the Eastern Conference Championship game,
mm-hmm.
or the Eastern Conference playoff game, the one that they played,
mm-hmm.
in Queens, because they couldn't play it at Yankee Stadium of the Yankees.
Yeah.
They need to get that one sorted. And playing mm-hmm. in Yankee Stadium is just not tenable. I think they need to get the New England Revolution out of Foxborough.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed seeing the likes of Minnesota move into their new stadium and benefit and go from basically worst to playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the stadium issue, we've seen the benefits of the fixed stadium as well. I mean, we saw it last year with DC United. And the issue with New England has been one that we've discussed, but that's been an issue for a number of years. That is something they have to take care of. I feel like a club like New England as well that's been in Major League Soccer pretty much since the start of the league and we have expansion teams coming in that are able to put down roots in an area and actually get a soccer-specific stadium that is attractive and reachable to fans. And you really haven't seen that, and you haven't seen that at all in New England. And I think that's sad. They should probably try and end up somewhere closer to the city proper if they can. They have to work that out, or just leave the area altogether. You're seeing Orlando City has a stadium, and you know they were trolling the Miami Internacional team and how they're not sure where they're going to end up playing, and how I think it was like the area was a swamp or something like that. But you know that it's an issue, but you're seeing new teams are focusing on that primarily, and you would hope to see teams that are a bit better established spend a bit more time on that. And of course, I don't know the issues of everything facing New England Revolution, but it would be best if that squad can move out of that area. Especially as the league is growing and you're seeing, I mean, we can talk about the quality of play all we want. The interest in the league is growing. I mean, the attendance figures prove it. The interest is growing. And you would hope to see that that stadiums and soccer-specific stadiums are being able to be established. And, of course, we don't need these 55,000, 60,000 seaters. You don't need to do that.
Another one next year because Chicago Fire are going back to Soldier Field.
Going back to Soldier Field, which we were both like, okay. But we could see both. I mean, we clearly saw both sides of that issue. But it's something that I feel like if you want to continue to attract foreign eyes, because the game has to have foreign eyes. It's still soccer. That the stadiums they play in can't have lines for American football and gridiron football on there. It just can't. It just looks bad. And it looks bad for the league as a whole.
You don't want to be a tenant in the stadium when you're trying to make a stadium a statement.
Right.
But we, I would figure in terms of attendance, I know in terms of attendance, this is one of the more successful league seasons in terms of viewer ratings. Everything points to a league that continues to trend up, and it will be continuing to expand next year as we welcome even more new teams in, and they reconfigure the schedule again.
Yeah, and I want to piggyback on what you said just really briefly, that I was actually also pretty, I don't want to say surprised, but I was really pleased with the style, with the level of play in that championship game. You know, it was relatively attractive to watch, and it was entertaining.
It was a good game. I think maybe because of the time, maybe because of coming in and watching it, having watched Manchester United and Liverpool almost immediately before, it was missing something. I still felt like it was missing something as compared to last year's final, which just had the air of a proper cup final. Which is not to say that the fans in Seattle weren't out in full voice and doing a great job. Maybe it was because the stadium was closed last year and it just ratcheted up the decibel volume and you could just hear it so much more clearly.
Right, yeah.
There was just something about it that just didn't necessarily feel right. And I almost wanted to say in my notes that it just felt like a very MLS final. Where... But for the jerseys on the team last year, I wouldn't have known you could have put them in a German kit, and I would have believed that that game was being played over in Germany.
Yeah, fair enough. I tend to keep – but, you know, I don't know. I think just because I probably had a similar reaction, but mine was more of, remember, you're not watching Manchester City versus versus Liverpool. So I probably so I was watching it in that vein of I think my vein of expectation for a much lower quality game was there. So which led to, but it's probably good because it led to me being a bit more pleased than I think I normally would have.
But and it was a good final. And congratulations to Seattle. And that will officially wrap up our coverage of the MLS
until March.
When they are back. So,
and we won't know what's going to happen at the beginning of that season either.
Yeah. As we move on, we want to give a shout out to Playing Against Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment. They had quite a Sunday as they had Celtic, Manchester United, and then Liverpool, Man City. So that place was hopping this weekend. It was a great place to be. And I guess we got to talk about that game because Liverpool trotted out 3-1 winners over Manchester City to go 8 points clear after 12 games. Now, we were in a somewhat similar state last year, but it just felt like watching it that City was just so far behind Liverpool. And though the Liverpool fans don't want to say it, it looked like a, maybe not the nail in the coffin, but the lid is starting to close on that one. And I actually thought that City started out better.
They did, yeah, I
that
agree.
First Liverpool goal came to me a bit against the run of play. And City had had a couple of attempts, and, you know, Aguero was off. He clearly missed a couple of ones that I'm used to him scoring. And that could have made all the difference. But that first City goal kind of came against run of play, and then all of a sudden, I guess maybe like 10 to 15, it seemed like almost rapid succession that they were up 2-0 and you knew at that point it was basically game over for City. Now you and, hear a little bit about VAR and handballs and stuff like that, but I don't think that VAR played any role in it as much as, you know, Liverpool were just a better team.
Yeah,
that's City do have an appalling record away to Liverpool. over the last, I think the last time that they've won there was like in 2003.
Yeah, and I don't think that like Raheem Sterling hasn't been able to score there since he played there. I think that I think that was the stat they named. I agree. The first call was a handball. I mean, it was. It probably should have been a penalty kick. But the part that disturbed me about City was it seemed like, I mean, and it could just also be a trend, or it could be just my vision of a trend, because I think it's there that it may not be there. But it seems like whenever there's a questionable issue, within half a second, players of the team that feel they're being that the ref has not called a foul in their favor are up in arms about either a call or a no call. And in that split second of a game, you know, if you looked where the ball was at, I think it was right. It was not far from Aguero's feet, and he has his hand up in the air and he's looking at the referee. And it's like, I feel like because the VAR has opened up the door to penalties and closed the door to penalties, and we've talked about the inconsistencies, and it has an effect on the players because then they're thinking about this other element of the game that should be there. And when it's not there, it takes them out of their focus away from the play. Because like it or not, you still have to play the game. And it seemed like City turned off. And then Liverpool was able to counterattack, and through a wonderful finish by Fabinho, boom, they were up 1-0. And the disappointment of that no call carried over the next 5 minutes, because then Salah scored again in the 13th minute. So I was really watching that game going, okay, you didn't get a call, but you still have 80 minutes left to play, and you are the team that scores more goals than basically everybody else, almost double sometimes. If anybody can bounce back from a 1-0 deficit, even if it is to Liverpool, it's Manchester City. Anybody could bounce back from a 2-0 deficit, even against Liverpool, it's Manchester City. So I'm looking at Pep made a fool of himself holding up the two fingers when the ball that the second handball that was claimed by Trent Alexander-Arnold, that really was no way that could be interpreted as a handball other than somebody who's already wrapped up. And then the way he was shaking the referee's hands after the game, I don't know. I lost a bit of respect for Pep after that. I get the frustration, but I think to carry yourself that way for a team that's had as much success as Manchester City's had, who has as much success as Pep Guardiola has, was really, I don't know, I thought he kind of disrespected himself. But that's just my opinion. I'm neither here nor there. But I felt like City turned off when they shouldn't have, because they have the firepower to come back from anything.
He says that he does that after every game.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No. Come on, man. He's going to say that, but he does not do that. He's not that demonstrative. You saw the look on the referee's face. He was obviously disturbed by that interaction. And Pep looked him dead in the eye and did it to all three refs and played it up as loud as he could because he knew the cameras were right on him. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Pep. Nobody's that. No, lots of people are that stupid. I'm not that stupid. It was blatantly obvious what you were doing. And he can say he wasn't all he wants to, but I just don't buy it.
But apparently that game did not go well for Pep. It also, Raheem Sterling will now be out for the upcoming England qualifier due to a run-in that he had with Joe Gomez during England training.
Really?
Yeah, oh, just came across the wire.
What? Yeah, I just popped that up. Wow. It's also Daily Mail. Daily Mail is going to make it sound a lot worse than it really is, but I got Daily Mail on the
I
front.
Didn't get it off of Daily Mail. I got it off of BBC.
There we go. I'm seeing the BBC. I always skip down to one of the other ones, but wow,
yeah,
look at
I
that.
I saw the BBC.
Oh, interesting.
So I saw it off BBC, but they came in and said that he had a run-in with Joe Gomez, and as a result, Gareth Southgate said the emotions are too high for them to play together in this upcoming game.
Yeah, well, Raheem, I mean, you saw the play. I mean, Joe Gomez did give Sterling a little bit of a shove. I think Sterling, of course, is very – I mean, he's got to protect himself in a lot of ways. I mean, like it or not, he's a small guy. I mean, 5'7", maybe 140, 145. He's not a big dude. And so I could see him definitely having to be a bit cautious around getting pushed up against the fence and everything like that, especially a player as quick as he is. But, you know, I was watching that, and at first I thought Raheem was overreacting. I was like, come on, man, stop being – but then I saw the replay, and I was kind of like, oh, okay. I do get why he was upset. It's a shame that they couldn't bury this and go, let's come together because we got to play against England. I guess it's also easier to say that Raheem would be eliminated if they're playing against Montenegro as opposed to playing against Spain. So when you're playing against a team that may not quite be as threatening, it's easy to say, you know, why don't you sit this one out because you're getting a little hot in the collar.
He's had a reputation for being a bit of an emotional player.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at – it's funny you bring up Spain. When you look at Spain back in the Euro World Cup years, that was a team that was composed almost entirely
mm-hmm.
of Barcelona and Real Madrid.
Yeah, Real Madrid. Mm-hmm.
Who would go out and do the same thing but then have to come back
mm-hmm.
on Spain duty and figure out mm-hmm. a way to play with each other.
Right. And that division was also, you had players who were definitely of Catalan origin who were having to play on Spain mm-hmm. duty. So, you know, I think that takes away any excuse, but go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. My bad.
But no, but that's exactly what it is. That mm-hmm. idea that you have to, when you put on your national team jersey, leave the club allegiances mm-hmm. behind. And if you mm-hmm. had a tough game against somebody, as hard as it is, you have to walk off and say, you know, this ended here. Now, I understand it's a bit different insofar as they just played yesterday,
mm-hmm.
and now they've got to be teammates. But mm-hmm. you've got to let that go. And
mm-hmm.
granted, it is Montenegro, but what would have happened had it been Spain? What would have happened had it been France? What would have happened had it been a more meaningful game? Would that
mm-hmm.
decision have still been made? Would they have been able to play together? You know, it's a maturity thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he's going to have to be able to adapt and not carry those things through that emotional that emotion that sense of aggrievement
mm-hmm.
into the international break because he's
mm-hmm.
got a job to do for England. Now, fortunately, they have the likes of Rashford and Jadon Sancho that can come in and do that job out on the wing for him, so they can get away with not playing him. But
mm-hmm.
if this was a more serious game, given how he's playing right now, that could have been a major loss for England.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if it was a major game, I think Southgate's approach would have been much different. He would have had the two of them in his office saying, you know, lock the door and go, y'all ain't leaving until you work this out. One of those situations. You know, and you're looking at Sterling too. I mean, I have bestowed a lot of respect on Raheem Sterling recently, but he's still only 24. And, you know, a lot of – I mean, Gomez is 22. They're still babies. So I'm not going to say I disagree with the decision. I think it wise to let cooler heads prevail and let him take the day, cool off a little bit. The fact that he was dismissed and not Gomez, though, leads me to believe that he was probably the one that initiated the dust up in the first place, if there was one. So it's probably for the best. It's not a bad choice by Southgate to say, because we're playing Montenegro, I can give some other guys some run and get him, you know, get some other guys a cap. Let's go ahead and have Raheem sit this one out. I think it's not necessarily.
I also think it's Southgate showing him, like, yeah, you're a part of this team, but you're a part.
You're
of
part.
This team. You are not the guy.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? You are not the guy. You are not to this team. You're not Kylian Mbappe. You're not Lionel Messi.
No.
You are Raheem Sterling.
You're Raheem Sterling.
You are good.
Yes.
You are not the team.
You're not the team.
We can
no.
get
and,
by without you.
Right. And I don't think anyone on England I don't think there's any player on England that they could ill afford to leave behind. I'll put it that way. Now, I'm saying that as an individual basis. I think if there was multiple players, that would be a different story. But I think if with all hands on deck, I don't see there being a single England player that the team couldn't have an equally as strong performance without them being on the field.
I think the closest you could come would probably be Harry Kane. We've seen them get by without him, but certainly having Harry Kane in the middle when Harry Kane is doing what Harry Kane does makes them a different team.
Agreed.
And he is the one player on that team right now that I don't think they have a natural substitute for.
Agreed, but his form as of late hasn't been quite as strong. So, I see that, yeah, but I don't know. I still don't see him in the same likes that a France would see a Kylian Mbappe, I'll put it that way.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. So as we talk about the England national team, how about the U.S. men's national team as they get ready to go up against Canada in a must-win? It still seems weird even spitting that out of my mouth. A must-win game against Canada.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what's worse, the fact that I could see a must-win game against Canada. That's easy enough to see. Like, it's a competitive fixture. But I think what's even more troubling is the fact that we're going into this game in Orlando, and it's a must-win against Canada, and I'm not sure that we can win it.
Yeah. That's because Canada can just sit and try to play for a draw. It sounds so funny to think of a rivalry game is against Canada. Like this could be turning into a budding rivalry game where Canada is actually a real threat to qualification spots against the United States. I really hope I am way out kicking my coverage here. But the fact that we're discussing it is relatively humorous. But they have players playing in some top leagues around the world. But you know, the majority of them are still playing in Canada for MLS teams or for like the professional club and the professional Canadian club, the Canadian Premier League that they happen to have. A couple of guys playing in Mexico, a couple guys, you know, a guy on Rangers. It's definitely a more of a talented squad than they've had, I'd say, ever. Their squad's relatively young, too. They have some older heads, but their squad's relatively young. Not a whole lot of caps have gone around for the current call-ups. So, it could be a squad that can hopefully kick around with U.S., Mexico, and whichever Central American country seems to be the more dominant one at the moment. But, I mean, Pulisic isn't there. Zach Steffens isn't there. Altidore is not going to play. Bradley's
out
to play. He's out as well. So, look at who the squad has. The squad still has some players that haven't been featured relatively recently. I'm speaking more of John Brooks looks like he's coming back into the fold. Weston McKennie should be getting on the field, hopefully. Will Trapp will be there. We have Josh Sargent. Hopefully he'll start. I think he should. And, of course, our old boy, Gyasi Zardes, is there. So we'll get Matt on to talk about his play next week. So,
what the biggest problem is that I see.
Right, they still can't score.
They still can't score. And I think the absence of, I think it would be a different one. John Anthony Brooks being back, and he's gone 90 the last couple of Bundesliga games.
Mm-hmm.
So he looks to be back in full fitness.
Mm-hmm.
He brings a steady head back.
Yep.
You can look at the goalkeeper lineup and you can see that it's most likely going to be Brad Guzan.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Bradley's absence, I think, is favorable for Jackson Yuhl and Weston McKennie, because if we go based on what we saw in the last set of fixtures, Will Trapp has slid behind Jackson Yule in the pecking order.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them would be in if Tyler Adams was there, but he's not. He's injured. My concern is still on the wings.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the squad too, it's a very there's not a whole lot of midfielders even coming. I mean, they're going to bring six midfielders to this game, so it looks to me like they're going to be playing like a 5-4-1 or a 5-3-2 lineup, which you're going to be it looks like it's going to be Sergiño Dest and Yedlin playing on the wings, hopefully providing that type of outside attack that we all seen Yedlin do this. Props to Yedlin for a beautiful goal over the weekend, but it appears that that's the lineup they're going to have. And so that is concerning because, as you were discussing before, Sergiño Dest and Yedlin seem to play the same position, so they're going to have to put him on the other side.
And I think he's capable. You know, all of his starts for the men's national team have come on the left back. And if he's willing to play left back, and I think they told him that. And if I'm him, I'm looking, I'm saying, hey, I might like to play right back, but it's much easier for me. There's a clear path if I go to the left. You know, we're not looking for anything other than like Steve Tarantolo, who can basically just serviceably hold down that position. You know, I don't need Danny Alves out there. I just need Steve Tarantolo.
Right.
And if that's what he's going to do, and he's had guys in for the last couple of weeks, that's the other thing. Is just it so reminds me of the Panama Trinidad games where they spent all this time preparing for Panama and then lost to Trinidad. Because they weren't ready. And are you taking Cuba for granted? Now, given that it was 7-0, given that this game is in Georgetown Grand Cayman, you know, how Cuba has played, I would think that losing to Cuba, failing to win against Cuba, would just about be the worst defeat that I can think of.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they have they have to play. And I don't like it when he does this and says, okay, you know, for this game, I'm going to come out in a 3-center-back, 5-back system. Given the look of the lineup, it looks like that's what he's going to have to do because, like, there are only 5 forwards and there are only 6 midfielders.
Right.
And Paul Areola, to me, Jassy Zardes can play wing, but Paul Areola and Jordan Morris look like the only wingers. So I would imagine if you started with the typical 4-2-3-1 sort of system or 4-4-3-3 system that he's played, you're going to have a lot of Paul Areola and Jordan Morris, but there's not a whole heck of a lot of cover for those two guys.
Right.
And neither one of them, Jordan has played well in the playoffs, but Areola has sort of plateaued for the U.S. men's national team.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're reliant on some sort of strike partnership or strikers of Josh Sargent, who's unproven, Jassy Zardes, and Tyler Boyd, who we know what they are, and we're not overly impressed.
Right. Right. Yeah, well, so they don't have much of a choice, I think, with this particular lineup. And you know what? They noticed something with maybe Berhalter noticed something with Canada that gave him the sense that there's something I can exploit and play within my system, but there's areas where I can exploit based on this particular set of talent. And, you know, it could be something that's relatively exciting. I'm just going to go back to the Dest Yedlin pairing on the wings, that could be something that's quite exciting to watch. It could. Yedlin is still only 26, so this could be something that could be going on for a long time. And as we've seen, left backs or wing backs can play for a very long time on the national team, as you already mentioned with Gerundolo, and we see DeMarcus Beasley turning his career around with the U.S. national team by becoming a wing back. So it could be something that could blossom into a fruitful kind of like two players that have a position on lock. But the scoring still is what worries me. I mean, you're right. You know, for a forward, Areola, 30 goals, 30 caps, 5 goals. He doesn't seem to his game. He's listed. He's a winger, much less so than a forward. And so you're looking at this five. You know, you don't see where the goals are going to really come from. Is what really makes me nervous. Because even in the midfield, is McKinney going to be scoring the goals? You know, I just don't see a lot of firepower. And so that's the only thing that really gives me a little bit of pause. And some of these goals too, you know, with all the goals on the, I kind of feel like you should take away some of the goals that were scored in that Cuba game, because Cuba didn't know where the ball was half the time. So it's a little worrisome. I'm actually going to be, I'm going to record this game because I really want to watch specific elements of the attack and see if it looks like what I expected to, which is you have the ball being controlled out of the back from players who really aren't skillful enough to do it, and then being at a point where you have offensive players doing a lot of ball watching and then running after the ball as it finally gets cleared out, and then not actually be able to maintain much possession.
My concern is something that we talked about with Coach Matt, which is putting guys in positions where you're asking them to play a role that they're not used to playing.
They're not used to playing, yep.
Which is, if you go to a three-back system, most of those guys don't play with three center backs
right.
on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's like two of the guys can do it. Like, you have two of the three backs can actually play a three-back system.
Yeah, and you need to have all three, because that's a communication thing.
Right.
Now, I understand it. When you have three center backs, you're asking them to take up space.
Mm-hmm.
And it lessens the defensive responsibility on any two.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a guy like John Anthony Brooks who's coming back off of a long-term injury. You know, maybe you don't want him to be responsible for moving around as much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't like it because of the communication that's necessary to make that work. We've seen those lines get crossed easily. And when you have the speed of a Davis in there, a Davis in there, it makes it easy to create disruptions, which is what I think that Canada is going to try and do. And I'm concerned. I don't see where the goals are coming from, and I'm concerned that they're not going to be able to prevent them either, which will leave us in a situation where, yet again, Greg Berhalter has failed to win a game that he needed to win. These, I guess if you want to call them big games, the fact that this is a big game is a little bit troubling, but another big game, another chance to go to a championship, I find it problematic if he does not win it that we have this problem. And could a potential set of the negative results in this round of international fixtures spell an end to Greg Berhalter after less than a year?
Well, I mean, I'm sighing because if that is the situation, and we saw what an issue the U.S. had with finding a coach between before they brought in Berhalter.
Was it really an issue, or were they really just looking at letting him
finish his season?
I think
it's an issue. I'm sorry, that's an issue. It's the best coach in American soccer, and his best job in American soccer. And I don't know.
But could you bring in a Greg Bain from Toronto?
Yeah, you could, but see, well, is Vanny better suited at coaching players at their level and getting the best out of them, or is he going to also try and implement a system where he hopes the players will be able to develop? When we spoke with Coach Will about that, how there's this loss of basically individual skill between the core developmental years of players, of American players, to when they get to pros, like where something's killing it. Is that going to happen again? So, I don't like rapid switching of coaches, because it seems the teams that do that the most are the ones that are the least successful. So I'm hoping that it won't come to that point. But it's U.S. soccer. There's no confidence that it can't get to that point, if you understand what I mean.
There's no confidence, because when we look at where we are right now, there's no reason to be confident.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, we are talking about a game against Canada as must-win, which in and of itself is not radical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a qualifier against Canada would be defined as a must-win, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, we're not confident right now that we can win it. Now, I don't want to make this sound like Canada bashing. I have fought for a couple of years, at least one World Cup cycle, maybe more, that Canada was on the rise and that they had the potential, that they had everything they needed. And they could come in and become a team, right? It just so happens that now they are. So I don't want to make it sound like we're bashing on Canada, like they're so far beneath us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a team that has legit talent.
Yeah.
MLS has been very, very good to them.
Right.
And they deserve the credit. They deserve to be on the rise. And if they get past the U.S., they deserve to go into the Nations League finals. And, you know, will they beat Mexico? Probably not, but it'll be good for them, and it'll be good for their development, and especially ahead of the 2026 World Cup, which is going to be hosted over there. It would be nice to see them be competitive and actually like deserve the spot that they're going to get. I think they will.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're looking at... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I think it says more about the fact that where we are with the U.S. program, where we just see all these glaring weaknesses, the likes of which I have not seen since probably the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was due to poor coaching, because the talent was there for the United States in the late 90s. But also the Canadian team, I mentioned earlier that there's definitely talent, especially young talent, but you're looking at their five strikers that they're bringing up, and you know, Jonathan David at 19's got 11 goals for Canada. You know, Alfonso Davies has 5. Junior Joliet is a little older, he has 9. So Lucas Cavallini's got 11 goals for Canada. So they have power to score goals. They can, you know, you're looking at Dwayne DeRosario, who, I mean, I thought a glaring issue for Canada was the fact that their all-time leading goal scorer only has 22 goals. So, but that looks like that's about to change. So when we're talking about where the goals are coming from, that's my biggest concern, because you look at the Canadian team and they know where their goals are coming from, and those guys are going to be playing on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're possibly going to be joined by Coach Gene a little bit, but as we wait for him to call in, I want to move on and let you get your rant in and take this time for some therapy. Talk about the woes of North London.
How you doing, Coach?
There's Coach G.
Next topic. I'm so sorry about this, man. So sorry, guys.
It's all good.
How are you guys doing today?
We're doing great,
man. Great
until
about 30 seconds ago.
Yeah, right? Sorry about that. Okay, we're going
to
be talking about Arsenal now.
Well, we can also always heap on the other team in North London and talk about Tottenham, who also failed to win.
Yeah, we kicked Spurs
while
they're down.
Another story.
Yeah. I mean,
all right, let's talk about
ahead,
Arsenal
coach.
And the woes.
Yeah. Go ahead, Coach.
It just sucks. You know, watching how incomplete the transition from defense to offense for Arsenal, then somehow they want to keep on going back to their goalie and start from square one all the time. And watching Liverpool and Man City yesterday, they never went back to their goalie. They were always offensive. They were always attacking. They were always trying to score. So watching teams that have a better idea of how to play the game, and watching Arsenal, it just seems like something's missing. Something's not clicking. Even as a player, if I notice that something's not working, I will not go and keep on doing that. It's kind of common sense. Like if your mom told you, don't touch that, you know, that hot stove, and you eventually go and keep on doing it over and over again with the same result. You keep on getting burnt. So you might want to try something different. And it just seemed like yesterday they were just trying nothing different. Even the 85th minute, they're keep on going back to Leno and starting from the defense, going all the way back to forwards. It just did not work. And something's just not clicking right now with Arsenal. And it's going to be kind of disappointing to see them maybe finish top 10 this year the way they're going right now.
Yeah. And despite all of that, you guys are still sitting in sixth.
That tells
you where the Premier League is.
Yeah. I said they were the worst third-place team I've ever seen when they were in third place for that week and a half. But throughout the recent campaign, you know, Arsenal has not – when given opportunities to succeed in any way, they seem to shoot themselves in both feet and in the left arm and in the knee. They do not take advantage of any opportunity that they have. And you're looking at this game going, when Leicester was playing at their best when they won the league in 15, they lost three games. Two of those losses were to Arsenal. And you're now looking at a Leicester team that looks better than that team was, and they completely outplayed Arsenal in all three phases of the game. Outside of goalkeeping, because Brent Leno is the only reason why Arsenal is not losing by more goals than they're losing by, how they're able to get a draw every now and how they're able to get draws, because that's the only thing that's been keeping them afloat is the draws, because they could easily have losses in all those games. I'm looking at Matteo Guendouzi, who seems to have some sense about him, is just grabbing guys left and right. He's tackling players. I'm not sure where he's supposed to be in positioning. He's in no man's land way too often, but I feel like he was told to be there. And you're looking at David Luiz, who is getting killed for some reason, but I'm looking at him going, he's the only defender who appears to be in relative position to protect the goalkeeper. And and the midfield, and it looks like they are – as you said, there's no transition from defense to offense. There are two different squads out there where the offensive players have no idea what the defensive players are doing and how they're going to receive the ball. And when the offensive players do receive the ball, the defensive players don't know how to give any support and push up the field at all. So I just don't understand. It's like they're relying on mistakes from the other team to mount any sort of attack. And they are basically saying, Aubameyang, please work your magic to keep us alive, because that's all that they're doing. And to see I'm not going to fully blame the coach, and I'm rarely a full-on coach blamer, but this situation, I am directly blaming the coach. I'm not calling for his head. I'm not saying he needs to go out. He's got to take damn responsibility, though. Take responsibility. This is your fault. This is a talented team. This is your fault. And guess what?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else around you isn't playing well. The fact that you're still in sixth is ridiculous. You're sitting behind Sheffield. You're lucky to be where you are. And it's appalling that they're in this position, because I feel like the place that they're in is giving them this false sense of hope that they're not far away. When you are far away, you are so far away from the goals you set earlier in the year. And if you were to play Champions League with this particular level, you'd be losing to CSKA Moscow on a weekly basis. So that's
yep.
I'm done for the week. That's my rant.
But you can't take anything away from Sheffield United, though. Whatever Kool-Aid they're drinking, whatever it's in there, it's working. Like, I don't know, their motive to, you know, from last year to this year, obviously now they're in the top league, but they're just, they're firing all cylinders. Like, you got to give them props. And, you know, we had our, you know, fan weird pick of, you know, preseason, stuff like that. And none of us were even had them in our little, you know, make-believe conversation, but holy cow, you know, good for them. It just shows that, you know, any small market team, you know, with the right kind of chemistry, like Leicester, and like you said, in 15, even Sheffield right now, the right kind of chemistry, you can do a lot of great things with less talent and less money, you know, given and stuff like that. So whatever Sheffield United is doing, man, just props to them.
Yeah, I want to also props to Sheffield because they're fun to watch too. They're exciting. And you know, they play like guys from Sheffield you would expect them to. They are not afraid to get hit in the face, and they'll just keep flying right at you. Yeah, good, you know, I applaud to Sheffield when their games are on. I'm actually enjoy watching them.
I don't think any of us picked Sheffield to do anything other than go down.
I don't think so either. I mean,
going to take credit for picking Leicester as a team to watch, but I think that had more to do with the fact that none of y'all mentioned them, and somebody needed
I'm
to
not gonna
more
lie.
Than anything that I saw from Leicester saying, like, yeah. Now, you know, that midfield with Ndidi and James Maddison has come good again. And, you know, they've been able to replace Drinkwater and N'Golo Kanté with Maddison and Ndidi. Vardy, although he's gotten a little older, is still putting
goals
away.
He's still Vardy, man.
And he's still as good as it. And they were – Leicester was good value for the two goals. And they played with the confidence that I didn't see from Arsenal in picking up that win. I think it is odd when you look at the teams that are there, thereabouts, and the fact that this league is just so weirdly condensed now from 5 to 15, where United, any sort of result on Sunday in the Wolves game against Aston Villa, combined with Manchester United loss, would have left United in 15th. As it was, a 3-1 victory put them up in 7th with a superior goal difference.
Absolutely.
But only 1 point behind Arsenal.
Yeah.
So they can sit there and say, you know, hey, after all of this going into November, we finally put together a month where, and this being United, where we actually kind of played halfway decent. The loss to Bournemouth aside, we got the draw against Liverpool. We still have not conceded the goal in the Europa League. And we actually scored multiple goals, not only away from home, but in the majority of our games. So they can be sitting pretty on the flip side. You have Arsenal, who just look confused, and I would say even worse would be Tottenham.
Yeah.
Who knows what's really going on there?
Yeah, Tottenham is really, really looking bad, and you know, we also called this how, you know, Wolves were struggling earlier in the year, but we kept saying, you know, we'll see what Europa League does to the team. And it seems like Europa League has actually galvanized them a bit because they're winning there too. And Wolves are back up in eighth place, and they've got nine of the last out of the last 15 points they could have earned. And so they're looking dangerous again. And so you could see Arsenal also finishing below them. And but yeah, that logjam, if Newcastle gets a win, and Arsenal gets
right
lost, they're popped up right there too. So that should be even more fearful. Arsenal should be even more fearful. I mean, you're looking at Everton, who's in 15th, as you said, and they're 2 points behind Arsenal. And I had my head way up in Everton at the beginning of the year with the moves that they made. I thought they were going to be in 10th place. Yeah, and My picks this year have not gone well outside of picking Liverpool to win the league, because I had Watford being my team of surprise, and they got their first win this past weekend, so I clearly know nothing about this game. But Spurs,
it just seems like
Spurs is just, but you see them out there. Spurs look just as much in disarray as far as I don't know what they're doing as much as Arsenal does. Arsenal is just lucky enough to have one more win.
I think Spurs are the ones that confuse me more than anything else, because you can look at them and say, okay, you know, they did all right in their last two Champions League games against a Serbian team who, despite practicing for the last 2 days, I still can't pronounce this team's name. And I'm not even going to try it, because, look, you just should not have that many consonants before a vowel.
No. If you have more than one G in the name and they're not back-to-back, I don't know how you can work with that.
But that's a team that, I mean, they are top of the Serbian league. They've gone out in the Serbian league with 14 wins and one draw in their first 15, but it's also the Serbian league.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who you guys, that's who Tottenham has picked up their Champions League wins against.
Yeah.
In the group
it
that
seems like that's
only
team they can score against. I mean, they've scored 9 against them total, but that's the only team they can score against.
They got held by Olympiacos, who are bottom of the group right now. But again, Olympiacos has played Tottenham and Bayern Munich twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be a lot different when they have when they play Tottenham again, and you know they're done with Bayern Munich. Tottenham still has Bayern Munich and Olympiacos. It wouldn't be at all surprising to see them fall into the Europa League or London.
If they fall into Europa League, though, there's no saying that they wouldn't get dragged through the mud in Europa League either.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a fair few teams in Europa League that you like, you know. Roma's still there, Celtic, you know, they can't win away from home. But the Europa League is not going to be a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking over it today because I was thinking after this, can we officially anoint, after this weekend, Liverpool the best team in Europe? So I went through my trusty power rankings and stuff like that, and I went to 538, whose statistical analysis I actually love.
Mm-hmm.
You know who they actually still have ahead? Win in the Premier League? Man City,
yeah.
And as much
even
as
though
I
they're up 9 points, crazy.
Yeah, but for some strange reason, whatever statistical model 538 uses has Man City ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing about it is, as much as I want to argue with them, and I was getting on them last year because when Ole first came in and Manchester United went on like that 10-game run, and I thought for sure it's got to have that. No, it didn't do anything, and they were right. You know, they had pretty much the whole entire season. United finished pegged to finish sixth, and they were right. That's where it ended up. I'm wondering if their statistical analysis actually shows something that we don't know. But in their power rankings, they have in their club power rankings, they have Man City as the best team. I don't agree with that. I think based on what I've seen, I think Liverpool are the best team in Europe right now.
Mm-hmm.
That does not mean that they're going to win the Champions League, but it does mean that's what I see. But as we go out, and we've only got a couple of minutes left, did you catch UEFA this week say that they were considering holding the 2024 Champions League final in New York?
Oh, God.
That'd be dumb.
I'm going to go in the opposite direction. I'm like, if you make this announcement, can I buy tickets now?
I didn't say I wouldn't go. I didn't say I wouldn't go. I just...
You know how many Europeans would be pissed about that coming over to America?
Well, it's cheaper, given the price of the euro right now, it's cheaper for them to fly over anyway.
Yeah.
And most of the team,
true.
I mean, it's more of a corporate event. I don't know if it'll happen. It would rely very heavily on relevant sports to be able to organize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, day of the lawsuit against MLS and Zoom, because those are the people who organize the International Champions Cup. I don't know. They've struggled to get that off the ground. I don't know if it would actually work and how they would get around FIFA and the sanctioning and stuff like that.
Yeah. The AP is now saying it's not going to happen, but of course, never believe when they say nothing, something's not going to happen. Unless until you get to that particular case.
Something's going
to
happen. Give them 4 years.
And money talks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Money talks. You know, it would certainly be an interesting one. You know, they would have to schedule the game. They'd have to put the grass field in and stuff like that. It would be a big deal. I would go and see it. Like and that's one of those ones. I don't care who's playing.
I would go.
No.
You could have partisan Belgrade versus, you know, shoot, give me another team. versus PAOK Thessaloniki in Greece, and I would go.
I think they would be better served by putting the Europa League final over here first, because we've definitely seen them play that in some weird spots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Hello, Pakistan.
They played it in Baku last year in Azerbaijan.
That's
and
what
there
I'm saying.
Players
like,
couldn't
yeah.
even go, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah.
But
I would
go.
I would still go. I totally go.
Oh, yeah. We'd be the first thing up there.
Absolutely.
But, as we get ready to head out, parting shots. We'll start with you, Coach G.
I guess I have to endure a week and a half of thinking about how Arsenal is going to screw up, not this coming up weekend, but next weekend. Providing shots, life is good. Soccer is good. It's always good to watch and talk about soccer. This sucks that Liverpool's pulling ahead by quite a long way, and I don't believe with Man City coming back, 9 points on a BPL right now. It's kind of a poor stretch to come back, but it's good to talk about this. So apologize for coming out late, guys. But pretty sad is I love talking about soccer, and I appreciate you guys having me on again.
Absolutely.
No worries. Stead.
Party shots for me will be, if you are so inclined, please, please, please throw your support behind the U.S. men's national team and tune into the game against Canada. I think they need all the support they can get right now. And if you happen to be in the area, please go by the stadium, check out the game, get a jersey, and see what we have, because I have a feeling that this squad that they're going to be putting out there today is, or excuse me, on Friday, minus really two players, is going to be the best squad we're going to have for the foreseeable future. So hopefully this will work out. Other than the difference of having Pulisic in the lineup and Zach Steffens in goal, it looks like this is who we have. So go U.S.
I first want to give a shout out to Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for sports and live entertainment, and thank them for keeping us on the air and dealing with our buffoonery as they always do. Once again, a happy Veterans Day, although saying happy Veterans Day sounds a little bit weird, but a happy Veterans Day to all those men and women who have served or mm-hmm. are serving and continue to serve, so especially my brothers and sisters from the 404 Civil Affairs Battalion and Task Force Viking who served with me over in Iraq, my grandfathers who both served, my uncle who served, producer Paul who served, you know, Stead, your father, all those people.
And my grandfather, and my uncle, and my cousin.
And, yes, all of those men. So happy Veterans Day, and thank you again. We can't say it enough. Thank you for your service. As always, a big shout out to producer Paul for keeping the trains running on time. And, you know, we want to congratulate him on a rare appearance on the air as he helped lead in the show while we were sorting out some technical difficulties. Those of you who feel so inclined, go down and join him as he leads the Tampa Delphi Eagles Club. They've got a big game this weekend, the Eagles versus the Patriots. So they'll be down there. The Bay Area's lone Eagle Supporters Club. So, yeah, happy soccer. I heard from some of our friends across the pond who once again informed us that we suck. So we would like to thank Sean and Oliver for reminding me that we are Yanks and that we actually know nothing about soccer. Keep up the good work. So as we go out, thank you once again. It has been fun. We did awful this week. We'll try and do even worse next week. For Sted, Coach G, Producer Paul, I'm Mike. This has been the cast of thousands that back us up. Literally, it's like a mouse on a wheel. This has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. Thanks a lot.